You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look at why millennials aren't saving for retirement, even when plans are made available to them through their jobs. First, nearly 2 years ago, Russian hackers targeted government computer systems in Wisconsin, according to federal officials. Now there's a plan to test the state's election system this spring to find out just how vulnerable Wisconsin is to election hacking. Patrick Marley is with us now. He covers state government and politics for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Patrick, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
Well, Patrick, I want to start with a point that's kind of confusing to me. It seems like we've heard some different stories on what exactly was attempted to be hacked here in Wisconsin. What do we know?
It is confusing, and it's been more confusing because the federal government was pretty slow to let people know both publicly and at the state government level about the hacking attempt and that Russian actors were involved. And the story for a while there kind of changed as to what exactly happened, so people rightly might be a little confused. What they say is that in the summer of 2016, leading up to the election, there was an attempt by Russian hacker or hackers working on behalf of the Russian government. And what they did is they scanned a Department of Workforce Development computer system. So that's a separate state agency that obviously has nothing to do with elections, but that the federal government believes that that was an attempt to sort of find vulnerabilities in the state's IT infrastructure so that it could then go in and find a pathway to our voter registration system. They did not get in. The state's IT system identified the attempt to get into this Department of Workforce Development system at the time, but there are many attacks by many types of hackers on state systems because it's a large enterprise. And so they were aware of it. They say that they were aware of it, but not who was behind it, and only later found out from the Department of Homeland Security that this was a Russian cyber attack.
And this was something that was not just going on here in Wisconsin. Other states saw similar incidents, right?
That's right. The federal government has said that there were 21 states that were targeted by election systems. Many of them, like Wisconsin, they didn't get through. In a couple of states, things went further and raised, you know, greater concerns.
So here we are, another election year, fairly big election year. What are state and federal officials doing to sort of pre-test election systems?
Well, one thing is they say, as I mentioned before, the communication between state and federal government, at least with the election area of law, seemed to be terrible. And the State Elections Commission says that they feel like they have much better communication with Homeland Security. They have key people that they can go to. They're being apprised of what's going on better and getting higher security clearances so that they can get in. What we've learned recently is that they're planning this spring or summer to conduct a testing regime where the Department of Homeland Security over a couple weeks will act like hackers and try to break into our systems. This will even include a phishing exercise where they will send what they call malicious emails, or, you know, emails to try to get information, you know, act like you're a friendly person to try to pry information out about passwords and those kinds of things to the election clerks across the state. And their belief is that, you know, this will be a good way to test the resilience of our systems, identify any flaws we might have, and then, you know, patch those up so that we're better protected.
Talking to Patrick Marley from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about a state and federal effort to test Wisconsin's election system at various levels to make sure it is prepared to deal with potential hacking attempts between now and the November elections. Is there a sense, Patrick, among the people involved here that, yeah, there's a pretty good chance that somebody's going to try to hack in between now and November?
I think that there is the sense that we better be prepared. We better, you know, that the state should plan as if that is going to happen. I don't think anybody is willing to say that, you know, they think it will or they think it won't, but they're saying it's very clear that we need to have robust protections because it certainly seems like it could happen.
At what levels are they testing this? I mean, there's everything from voter rolls, voter registration information, down to, I guess, computers used at election sites themselves. Are they testing all across the board?
I don't believe that they'll be testing I can't say for sure about voting machines. The number one concern for everybody whenever they hear about hacking is, could somebody get in and change vote totals, right? That would be the worst possible outcome you could imagine. That is also the most difficult thing to hack because, the voter registration system is a statewide system in a central database. Many clerks have access to it, but if you could hack into that, you could start making changes to, who's registered to vote and who's not registered to vote. Voting machines, on the other hand, where you actually cast your ballots, are, standalone pieces of equipment that are spread out at thousands of different polling locations, and then that information from them is fed up the chain and compiled in various places. So you would have to hack, or someone would have to hack, individual machines in order to do that. That would be much more difficult because it would appear you'd have to get physical access to them to make changes to them, and you it's not like you just do it one or two times. You'd have to do it across the board. These machines are not connected to the internet, though sometimes they have USB ports where ballot designs are introduced. Some people have raised concerns that those ballot designs are pulled off from a website and that files could get corrupted, but it appears much more difficult to hack, get hacking into the machines than the voter registration system.
And Patrick, on a related note, in writing about this, excuse me, you also talked about some new technology maybe being tried out at voting stations?
Yes, that's right. So this is separate from the vote hacking testing issue, but we have this April 3rd is the election for state Supreme Court and local elections, and the state is sort of test driving at 5 polling locations in different parts of the state, what they call e-poll books. So, when you go into the polls, there's the big printout of all the voters who are registered at that precinct. You tell them who you are and where you reside. They look you up. They have two people cross-check, and then you present your ID, and they check it off and give you a ballot, or give you actually usually a number, and then you go get a ballot at a different table. This would be put that material on a tablet or a computer interface and would be quicker for the clerks, if everything works as planned, would be quicker for the clerks to find people. Sometimes, you go up there and they have a little trouble finding you as they look up alphabetically. They could type it in and find it more quickly. Like I say, they're test driving these, and then if things go well, they would make them available for the August and November elections, which would be much bigger turnout. It would be available at that point to any clerk in the state who wanted to use them, but it would be at the discretion of clerks as to whether they use them. So I think in some jurisdictions they might, and some they might want to stick with the paper ballots that they've got.
Patrick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
That's Patrick Marley, state government and politics reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us to talk about actions Wisconsin is taking to safeguard the voting system against hackers and to preview some new election technology. There's a slim chance you might see it when you go to vote in April. First, when it comes to saving for retirement, there are always hurdles to overcome and challenges to face, no matter who you are. For one group, millennials, things appear to be a bit more difficult. A new report from the National Institute on Retirement Security finds that 95% of millennials are not adequately saving for retirement, with the majority of millennials having absolutely nothing saved for their later years. There are some economic reasons at play. Rising student debt and wage stagnation are culprits. But does that fully explain the lack of savings? And what could be done to help young people put money away for down the road when they may face significant and more immediate expenses today? Jennifer Brown is manager of research at the National Institute on Retirement Security. She's the author of the Institute's new report, Millennials and Retirement, Already Falling Short. Central Time producer Chris Molina recently sat down with her to find out more about the unique challenges this generation faces when it comes to retirement savings.
So I'll admit, I'm a millennial, and I can tell you that saving for retirement isn't always at the forefront of my mind. Your report finds that, well, ultimately, I'm not alone. Give us the general breakdown of what you found here.
So we found that most millennials, and we used the individuals that were born from 1981 to 1991, even though Pew Charitable Trust has actually just cut the generation at 1996, we found that millennials are not on track for saving for retirement. In fact, we found that 66% of working millennials, millennials that are actively working and have a job, between the ages of 21 and 32, have nothing, not even $1 saved for retirement. So this leaves us with about one-third of millennials that actually have something saved for retirement. We also found that that one-third really isn't saving that great either.
So, Jennifer, as somebody who studies this, when you found that number, two-thirds of millennials having nothing saved for retirement, did that number come as a big surprise to you?
Yes, it did, actually, though I wasn't as shocked as I should be or theoretically would be, because Americans in general have a retirement savings problem in this country.
Mm-hmm.
I also know, because I also am a millennial, this generation's gone through a really, really tough time the last couple of years. You know, I am an older millennial. I'm 35, about to be 36. You know, and I watched a lot of my friends, and I also struggled myself to really get a good job, get that first wonderful good job out of my graduate degree, and, you know, have benefits and have a plan where I could actually have an employer help me save for retirement. And I even see this in my younger sister and her cohort of millennials, the younger millennials, where, you know, it really took them a little time to actually get into that good job that offers health care and that offers a retirement plan.
Yeah, and is it that millennials are working and choosing not to save for retirement, or is it that they are unable to save for retirement, or do we see both?
We actually are seeing more millennials that have access to a retirement plan, so they are working for an employer that potentially offers a plan, but that the millennials themselves are not eligible for a plan because they're either working part-time for an employer or they haven't worked long enough for that employer for them to actually be able to participate in that employer's plan. We still have a large number of millennials that are working in the on-demand economy or are sole proprietors. So they're working for themselves, and so they wouldn't have access to a plan. But we still find that there are more millennials that have access to an employer-sponsored plan but are not eligible to participate in one.
Okay, so let's say I'm 22, 23 years old. I'm not actually 22 or 23 years old, but I've got my first job out of school. I'm excited. I'm making some money. I'm not necessarily thinking I got to be stashing away money for when I turn 65, 66. You know, it seems so far down the road. I have expenses now. I've got student loan debt. But what are the consequences of not putting away money towards retirement when somebody is in their 20s?
Well, compound interest is going to help you when you're saving in your 20s. So it's actually easier. Your dollar that you save now is actually going to be many, 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 many more dollars eventually. But something that we found and we talk about in our report is that if your employer sponsors a plan and they offer an employer match, meaning free money for you or a reward for you to save for retirement, you should be taking advantage of that match because, you know, again, compound interest will work for you. Every dollar that you put towards now, you know, your employer can match dollar for dollar and give you $2 for one. And again, with the magic of compound interest, those $2 for one could end up being $10 for one, you know, in your 40s and 50s. If you put that dollar in your 40s and 50s, compound interest is not going to have as long of a time to work. And so it won't be, you know, 10 to 1 or $1 to $10. It will be a lot smaller.
So that sounds pretty significant. Let's say then I turn 30 and I haven't been doing that. And I think, oh my goodness, what have I been doing? Is it too late for me to start putting that money in to save for retirements?
Absolutely not. You should just start as soon as you possibly can, and you should definitely take advantage of any kind of, I call it free money, that you can get your hands on. Employer matches, the Federal Savers Credit, anything like that that helps you save. So no matter if you're 22 or 32, you know, you should be saving. You know, it's never too late. You should be taking active steps anytime that you can.
We're talking right now with Jennifer Brown, Manager of Research at the National Institute on Retirement Security. And your report finds that only about 5% of working millennials are saving adequately for retirement. But what does saving adequately actually mean these days?
Okay, so saving adequately is now defined as saving between 15% of your income and all the way up to 22% of your income. This standard used to be about 10%. That's the standard used for Gen X and baby boomers. But the financial experts have really upped that number to about 15% of this generation, and that's the standard that we use to assess whether or not this generation is saving adequately. From a dollars perspective, you might have actually heard that you should save $1 million for retirement. If you save $1 million, you'll be in a great place for retirement. That number has also been up to about $1.8 to $2.2 million, which is a huge figure. Yeah, scary huge figure.
Yeah. And, you know, you talked some about the employer credits and the matching. Do you think that employers are doing enough to educate their employees, especially younger employees, about the options that are out there?
So employers are actually doing a pretty good job of incentivizing their employees to match. The average last year was that 77% of employers offered an employer match, and the average match was 4.7%. But I think that employers are trying to educate their employees about what that is, but they may be not doing a good job about the match specifically. For example, the firm Financial Engines found that the average employee is leaving $1,336 on the table, meaning they're not contributing enough money, so they're getting that money back every single year. And this is especially problematic for younger employees. So what I'm thinking based off of this Financial Engines report is that for especially younger employees, they're not understanding why they should be saving and contributing enough to their retirement plans to get that 100% match from their employer and not leaving that free money on the table.
Do you think part of this can be explained by the fact that millennials grew up during this time of the Great Recession where they saw a lot of bad economic news, they saw a crashing stock market, they may approach investing in the stock market with some fear or trepidation, and knowing that a lot of retirement plans are tied up in the stock market, do you think we're seeing people kind of shy away from maybe saving for retirement because of that?
Oh, no. Actually, millennials want to save for retirement. They want to save. This is a generation of saving. This is much like the greatest generation, the generation that went through the Great Recession. You know, this generation really believes in saving and believes in their future. But they are actually worried about retirement. 29% of them have said that they are worried about saving for retirement. And they also do actually want to retire. They want to retire on their terms at when they want to retire. So this is a generation that actually wants to save, but they're just not given the tools to be able to do so. They're not having access to the easiest kind of retirement savings plan, the kind that's offered by an employer, because they are not eligible to participate in their employer's plan.
So what might policymakers be able to do to give millennials those tools that you're talking about?
So first off, you know, allowing part-time workers and allowing employees to contribute to a retirement savings plan right away when they join a job would really impact this generation. It would also impact minorities and also women in saving for retirement as well. As we have found in some of our previous reports, you know, women and also individuals of color are also burdened by these same problems about being part-time or not working for an employer long enough. So the first thing that policymakers can do is change the law. Allow part-time employees to contribute. Encourage employers to allow them to do so. Encourage employers and change the law and encourage employers to allow employees to contribute to a retirement plan the first paycheck, the first day of work. You know, that will really help in policymaker speak move the needle on this issue. Some other things that would really be great for this generation, there's this thing called auto-enrollment. That means I automatically enroll you in a retirement plan when you start working for an employer. And if you decide you don't want to save, you can opt out of that. But if the auto-enrollment works, and works especially for this generation, the financial firm Vanguard has found that 77% of this generation actually saves for retirement when they're auto-enrolled. And those are really great numbers. Some of the other things that we just talked about, you know, increasing employer matches and encouraging your employees to actually max out that employer match is a really great educational piece for employers, because this is how you get to that 15%. This is how you encourage people to actually save for retirement, especially when those 15% or that $1.8 million is so daunting. Employer matches help employees get there. And so, you know, upping employer matches, getting above 6% up into the 7 and 8% would be a great target, especially if you have young employees. But also that second part of encouraging employees to take advantage of that match 100% and not leaving any free money on the table. Lastly, there is a federal tax credit. You know, we're going into tax season now. There's a federal tax credit that rewards certain people, low-income individuals, middle-income individuals, to save for retirement. It's called the Federal Savers Credit. Again, you get rewarded for saving for retirement using this credit. A lot of people do not take advantage of this credit. This generation, because of their incomes, would be a wonderful target population to take advantage of the Federal Savers Credit. And last and not least, of course, protecting and strengthening Social Security is extremely extremely important for this education. There's a whole lot of misperceptions out there or misconceptions out there that Social Security isn't going to be around for this generation. It will be around, but if nothing else happens, millennials will have less Social Security for themselves rather than their parents or their or Gen X. And so there's going to be cutbacks for the millennial generation. So it's really important to keep Social Security strong and also keep contributing into the pot now so that we can actually have Social Security later.
Are you optimistic that things can change going forward?
Yes, absolutely. Again, as I said, this is a generation of savers. We have found in our report that when these millennials have the option to save in an employer-sponsored plan, they have the access to a plan, they're eligible to save for a plan, they are participating in these plans at above 90%. That is a huge, what's called take-up rate in our jargon. So that means that people really are ready, willing, and able to save when they are given the opportunity to do so. And so if we can just literally fix some of these eligibility issues about part-time work and offering employees a retirement plan on the first day of employment, we could actually make a huge difference in this generation.
That's a good place to leave it. Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you.
Jennifer Brown is Manager of Research at the National Institute on Retirement Security. She's the author of that group's new report, Millennials and Retirement Already Falling Short. She talked to producer Chris Molina. Now, the United States Treasury Department announced sanctions this morning against Russian individuals and organizations because of meddling in the 2016 election and other Russian cyber attacks. In a statement released by the department, the U.S. is targeting 5 groups and 19 people with these sanctions. Some lawmakers, including House Speaker Paul Ryan, called the restrictions long overdue. Our next guest is here to talk about the sanctions and what impact they could have on U.S.-Russia relations. Keith Darden is a professor in the School of International Service at American University. Keith, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back, Rob.
Keith, can you talk about what these sanctions do and what impact they might have?
Primarily, the sanctions are focused on 2 organizations. One is the Internet Research Agency, which was identified in the Mueller indictment of a couple of weeks ago as the primary actor that was running the cyber operations trying to influence public opinion in the 2016 U.S. presidential elections. And that was funded, that effort was funded by a man named Yevgeny Prigozhin. And almost all of these entities have previously been sanctioned. Prigozhin was under sanctions. The Internet Research Agency itself was not, but some of the entities that were involved in the manipulation of the elections in 2016 were already sanctioned. The other main target of the sanctions is Russia's military intelligence. So both the military intelligence organization itself and several top officials in the GRU, so the main intelligence directorate, which is the main organ of Russian military intelligence, were sanctioned in this round of sanctions. And that was partially for involvement in the 2016 elections, partially involvement for a major cyber attack that took place in 2017.
And now the Internet Research Agency is one thing. It was funded by a guy, I think that's the guy known as Putin's chef for
yes.
kind of a longstanding joke sort of. But the military intelligence agency, I mean, that is a state actor. It's directly connected to the Russian government. There's not that a window of deniability there, right?
Right. I mean, the deniability was sort of implausible with Putin's chef, with Prigozhin as well, because this is a person who, you know, was running a small restaurant in St. Petersburg and ultimately became a billionaire through state contracts that were handed to him by Putin. And he does all sorts of things for Putin. He's the one who built Russian military bases just outside the Ukrainian border that have been staffing some of the Donbass separatists. He's also involved with the mercenaries that are in Syria. He's very much what we would call a cutout for the Russian government, sort of a private actor, but not really private.
Do these sanctions do anything really significant to punish people involved in election interference and other cyber attacks, which we can get to, and to deter future efforts?
You know, it cuts them off from much of the international economy. But, you know, when you're a senior Russian military intelligence officer, you're not terribly connected to the international economy anyway. So I think and many of those people were already under sanction. You know, only a couple of names are new in this list. And so we know the sanctions haven't deterred their activity to date. So it's not likely to have a significant effect. And sanctioning a few additional people who are employees of the Internet Research Agency, again, not likely to have much of an impact.
A lot of the talk here in the U.S. has been about these sanctions as they relate to 2016 election interference. But a big part of it, cited by the Treasury Department, is the cyber attack called NotPetya back in the summer of last year. Can you talk about that attack and the scope of it a little?
Sure. I rely on government sources, but this was the largest or most expensive, the costliest cyber attack in history. It started as an attack on Ukraine, that they essentially embedded software in the Ukrainian tax website. So anybody who was going to get information to file their taxes would have been infected with this software. And it mimicked a software that was a ransomware, in other words, that would ask people to pay money in order to get their data back. But in fact, it had no intention of giving people their data back and was erasing data for any machine that was infected. And it spread beyond Ukraine to the United States and the UK and other European countries, shut down hospitals, schools. It was a terribly costly and devastating attack.
Talking to Keith Darden from American University about new U.S. sanctions against Russian individuals and organizations related to cyber attacks and interference in the U.S. election. And Keith, a new big international story that's adding another wrinkle to this, the apparent assassination attempt of a Russian who had spied on Russians now living in the U.K., a nerve agent apparently used. Big diplomatic tiff now between the U.K. and Russia, France, the U.S. kind of signing on behalf of the U.K. here. To talk about that story and what, if anything, it changes.
So I think, you know, and that's clearly related to the sanctions, the timing of this round of sanctions, which the Trump administration had really been putting off. You know, they're really just trying to send a signal that they're doing something, because it's clear that the Russians were involved in some way in this attack in the U.K. You know, a nerve agent that was developed by Soviet military chemists was employed. Very few people would have had access to something like this. It's in principle possible that, you know, sometime in the period after the collapse of the Soviet Union, some criminal organization could have gotten their hands on these materials. But this is very unlikely. It seems really that the Putin government was sending a signal that we, you know, almost like a mafia organization, you know, it's a very distinctive killing or attempted killing, which attributes, says basically, you know, you can't hide from us and we have this capability and we're willing to use it. So in some ways it's related to the Putin's speech of a couple of weeks ago where he, you know, showed all of these new technologies, new missiles, new nuclear weapons. It's a way of saying, you know, we still have chemical and biological weapons capabilities, too, and we're not afraid to use them on foreign soil.
With all this concern over that attack, the cyber attacks, can you talk about how the U.S. and Russia can be talking about important issues like what's going on in Ukraine and avoiding escalation there? What's going on in Syria and avoiding, U.S. and Russian personnel shooting at each other there?
Yeah, so the dialogue is still open, both on Ukraine and on Syria. And, you know, we may be coming closer to some kind of agreement on Ukraine that will help stabilize that conflict. But really, Ukraine is in a situation now where the Russian government has been seeking to destabilize the Ukrainian government. And if that goes too far, you know, Russia's going to have a real crisis on its hands. You know, Ukraine's a very large country, tens of millions of people. You really don't want that collapsing on your border. The Russians have been pushing for a UN-monitored ceasefire line along the territory between the Donbass separatists and the government-controlled forces. The U.S. and the Ukrainian government would like to see that line extended to the Ukrainian-Russian border, and that's not likely to happen. But there might be some room for agreement in an effort to reduce the killing there. In Syria, you know, while we have dialogue with the Russians, they also supported a group of mercenaries who attacked a U.S. Special Operations base a couple of weeks ago. And that unit was, we informed the Russians that we were aware of what those mercenaries were doing. We warned them off, and then ultimately they were pretty much annihilated by U.S. air power.
So that seems like in either of those situations, maybe more so Syria now, there is a risk of things spiraling out of control on the ground.
Absolutely, because, you know, why would the Russians test us in that way? You know, what could be the motivation to send a group of, you know, semi-officially sanctioned Russian mercenaries against U.S. troops? That's a direct confrontation between the United States and Russian forces. That wasn't invited by us. It wasn't initiated by us. And we were communicating with them about it, but they still went ahead. And so those are very disturbing signs, much as this assassination attempt in the UK.
We're talking to Keith Darden. He's a professor in the School of International Service at American University. He's with us to talk about sanctions the U.S. imposed on Russian individuals and groups earlier today, in part for meddling in the 2016 election, also for cyber attacks in Ukraine and elsewhere. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this decision by the Trump administration to impose these sanctions? Do you think they go too far, or are you looking for more from the Trump White House? What impact does this all have on U.S. foreign relations? And what are you watching for in the probe of Russian efforts to interfere in the 2016 election? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the sanctions the U.S. imposed against Russian entities and individuals this morning related to meddling in the 2016 election, cyber attacks, and more. We're joined by Keith Darden. He's professor in the School of International Service at American University. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about these sanctions and the timing of the sanctions? Were you hoping to see more from the Trump administration, or do you think we're doing too much to put pressure on the Russians? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll go to our callers now. Willem is with us in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that the Russians never have stopped meddling in our democracy. They're not waiting for the 2016 election. They're involved in this release the memo thing with the Russian bots traced to Russia. And I don't think they've ever stopped meddling in our democracy or in Europe or anywhere else. And I think Putin is, he's schooled since he was a young man in the art of deception, working in the KGB and now the FSB, and now as the, president of the Soviet Union. I feel like we're playing, he's playing chess and we're playing checkers, because our president, frankly, I don't think is up to the job.
Well, thanks for the call. First of all, Keith, can you talk about ongoing Russian efforts since the 2016 elections here in the United States?
Sure. Your caller, Willem, is absolutely right. And in fact, the worry is not just that he's playing chess and we're playing checkers, is that he's playing chess and, you know, our president is one of his pawns. But I think that the point that Russia has interfered in our democracy and the Soviet Union interfered in our democracy is absolutely right. I think that they've developed more effective techniques, in part something like the Internet Research Agency, which was subject to these sanctions, was not developed for influencing our elections. It was developed for influencing their elections and their public opinion. And so the skill that they have in making stories salient on Twitter and Facebook or Vkontakte, which is their version of Facebook, and they really have gotten good at this. And so that's new. Hacking emails, they've done for quite some time, but releasing those emails publicly in an effort to discredit one of the candidates to sway an election, that's also new. So I think it's absolutely correct that they have been trying to manipulate U.S. elections for quite some time. They just seem to have upped their game a bit, in part because they are manipulating their own elections And they're, you know, that's something the Soviet Union didn't have to do.
Thanks for the call, Willem. We'll go next to John in Madison. John, hi.
Hi. Good afternoon. I had a brief comment and a question. I'm suspicious of the Trump administration following through on the sanctions. So I'm wondering if there's an objective mechanism that the Trump administration cannot influence that will give us an accurate reading of whether or not these sanctions are actually being followed through, if the mechanisms in government are actually following through on the sanctions. And I'll just hang up and listen to the response.
John, thanks for the call. Keith, are there ways to know if these sanctions are actually sanctionifying?
So there are. I mean, we pursue cases, and the Treasury Department has been quite aggressive. It's interesting that the Europeans, although the Europeans imposed many of the same sanctions that we did, they have never sanctioned one of their companies. In other words, but the United States has. And so there is a legal record of the U.S. government taking action against entities that trade with some of these Russian actors that are on the sanctions list. And so I think we are quite serious about it. And, you know, companies, once this becomes the law, companies are quite careful doing their own due diligence to make sure that they are not in violation of the sanctions, almost to the point of, you know, doubling the effect of the sanctions, sort of going beyond what the sanctions explicitly prohibit in an effort to stay out of legal trouble.
John, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Alicia calling from Milwaukee. Alicia, hi.
Hi. I do have an appreciation for the question that the gentleman asked about some form of objective mechanism in which to determine that these sanctions are actually being upheld. However, at what point do we say, okay, I am tired of you insulting our intelligence, and we look at things for what they are and recognize that they're trying to recreate things so that you do have oligarchs in control. You do have people sitting here that are barely making $15 an hour and trying to get to a point where they can raise their family and feed their family without all of this unnecessary drama. I mean, it's simply a case, what I'm looking at here, that they're creating problems that we've already solved, and now we're going back instead of forward. So,
Alicia, thanks. Thanks for the call. If I get her right, Keith, she's saying that Putin's government and his efforts are trying to support an idea of oligarchy and inequality. I hope I'm not putting words in Alicia's mouth, in other countries around the world. Do you see that?
Yes, I think that's one of the, you know, the ways that they can have influence is that, you know, and that's sort of their read on politics more generally, that, you know, they sort of see every country as an oligarchy, and they kind of work with you know, private actors in an effort to manipulate state actors. So I think that's right, that may be one of the ways that they target our democracy. And yes, it's extremely frustrating. And I think the British are really reaching that point now. You know, this is not the first time, not the second time, not the third time that the Russians have killed someone on their soil or attempted to kill someone on their soil. And I think, you know, the repeated denials are starting to be met with a, you know, we've kind of had it, and, you know, we're going to start taking more aggressive action.
Talking to Keith Darden from American University about the U.S., Russia, and some new sanctions. We'll go back to your calls now. Steve is on the line in Sun Prairie. Steve, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You know, I think it was 2012 when Obama was running against Romney, and Romney brought up the Russians as being a problem, and pretty much universally was condemned by Obama himself during the debate, and then the media as a whole saying how the Cold War was over. So my question is what happened since that time when Obama said the Russians weren't an issue at all? And then it seems like a lot of the things the Russians have been doing has been to divide us. And you can go back to the war on women, you can talk Black Lives Matter, even the walkout yesterday. It just seems all this resistance and everything is feeding into exactly what the Russians want, which is a divided populace.
Steve, thanks for the call. A couple points there I want to get into, Keith. Mitt Romney was warning about this in the presidential election. Then President Obama running for re-election seemed to downplay Russia. Did the Obama administration not do enough on the Russian issue?
There's no question that the Obama administration underestimated Russia. And comments such as, you know, referring to Russia as a regional player or a bit player, these are the things that really aggravated Putin and led to, in some ways, more aggressive behavior on his part. But they were engaged in an expensive redevelopment of their military going back into 2008. You know, this is definitely something that we could have seen coming. And really, Mitt Romney does look a lot smarter in retrospect than he did when he made that comment. It really was right that Russia was preparing for a set of actions that we're seeing come to fruition now. And we didn't really address that. I think it really accelerated after events in Ukraine, so that in many ways, events that we weren't responsible for, but the Russians believed us to be responsible for, that is the ouster of Viktor Yanukovych, really pushed them over the edge in terms of seeing the West as a threat and wanting to take more and more extreme actions in their mind to push back against us.
And then to Steve's point about Russian goals of creating divisions in the U.S., it wasn't just election stuff. There were a lot of things online where it turns out Russian, say, Twitter feeds and things like that would support both sides of a controversial debate. We're even seeing evidence that those accounts were weighing in on riots in Milwaukee, for example. Can you briefly touch on that part of the Russian program?
Yes, and they're doing this in Europe as well. I think their view is that they were facing a united West and that they wanted to divide these countries internally and amongst themselves. So the more they can split off Hungary and Poland from Germany and France, the more that, you know, so Brexit was also something that they apparently invested heavily in promoting. And yes, you're right, they've invested an effort to sort of split Americans along key cleavage issues. Now, we created those cleavage issues. It's not like the Russians invented Black Lives Matter or our, you know, history of racial problems. But they are pouring gasoline on those flames very deliberately, and it's something we need to be cautious about.
Keith, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Keith Darden, professor in the School of International Service at American University. He joined us today to talk about sanctions the U.S. imposed on Russian groups and individuals this morning over their meddling in the 2016 election and other international cyber attacks. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, it looks like a plan to close the state's youth prison may be falling short in the legislature. We'll talk to a state lawmaker who's been pushing for big changes about what happened and what happens next. A guest takes us on a tour of endangered species of the upper Midwest. And on Food Friday, our guest shares great recipes to bring to potlucks and other gatherings. Plus, we'll meet a Milwaukee native who started making music on a video game program and is now a producer of R&B music in Los Angeles. That and a look at some of the top stories of the day and our weekly roundup of what's been going on in Wisconsin news and politics. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.